want to think about the connection between freedom and faith. And there's a couple reasons why, and this is sort of the foundational question I want to ask, is what's the connection between Christian freedom and political freedom? And in a lot of ways, and you heard this when I talked last night, that we are called as Christians to be free. Yet at the same time, we live in a country that uses the rhetoric of freedom pretty much nonstop. It's sort of foundational for our identity as Americans. You know, many of us talk about American exceptionalism. It's divinely inscribed in the life of America. And it's divinely inscribed, why? Because we're free. Assuming no one else is free. Or it also assumes something about freedom. And so I want us to think about that sort of rhetorical political freedom that we use in much of our political discourse and national identity, as well as our calling of freedom as sort of foundational for being Christian. You know, how do they relate? How are they tensive at the same time? And I'm going to talk about three, if we have time, three different ways I think freedom is used in both Christian and political ways. I have Luther up here. I'll probably do Luther last if we have time, because I want to touch Faith and Freedom Coalition, and then James Cone. So I want to start, too, with conceptions of political freedom. And there was a political theorist in the 40s, his name was Isaiah Berlin, and he came up with at least a conceptual understanding of freedom that hopefully will help us think about freedom. And he came up with sort of two basic definitions of what freedom is in the political system. The first one is, he calls it negative freedom. And by negative, he means I am a slave to no one. That's the way he described it. And by being a slave to no one, it means you are free from any external restraint at its most extreme. And external restraint includes law, includes institutional expectations, it includes government interference. And I think a lot of, in particular, Tea Party rhetoric has this definition of negative freedom at its core, which is also why I put the nice don't tread on me flag up here, though you probably can't quite see it as well. But there's negative freedom. I am a slave to no one. He also came up with another one called positive freedom, in which he calls I am my own master. And both these terms have been debated since he wrote this. It was just a short article about what they exactly mean. And what I'm stressing here with the idea of positive freedom is that it's about a freedom to fulfill and develop one's potential. It also implies a necessity of culture, government, and institutions. Because the only way we become who we are is through our culture, through our institutions. And the problem, then, it requires education, it requires a social structure that helps people have opportunities. And positive freedom then includes issues like civil rights laws, affirmative action. Because the problem is culture hinders you from being able to fulfill your potential, then culture is not allowing you to develop your positive sense of freedom. So on the one hand, negative freedom, I'm a slave to no one. Second, positive freedom, I'm my own master. Makes sense, at least for the time being. So, now, what's Christian freedom, or where do we start when we think about Christian freedom? And it's, we really start with Christ, but we start with Paul's interpretation of Christ. And what Paul said, he said a lot about freedom. And we'll start with Romans. And in Romans 6:16, Paul says this: do you not know that if you present yourself to anyone as obedient slaves, you are slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to righteousness? What is Paul saying about freedom here? Thoughts? freedom is connected to slavery, which I know in our culture is not exactly a word many of us like to use, which I think points out the sort of both Paul's context, where slavery was an accepted part of the Roman world, as well as the fact that if we think about what slavery means at its sort of most base, it means you're yoked to someone, you're tied to someone, you're not your own. And Paul is saying here is, guess what? You have two choices. You can be a slave to sin or you can be a slave to God. He's not saying that freedom is ultimate. That freedom means you can do whatever you want. He gives us a choice in a lot of ways. And I think this is the ultimate definition of Christian freedom. It's the recognition that we are never really free. We are always in bondage to something. The issue becomes what we choose to be in bondage to. Do we choose to be in bondage to our calling as Christians, or do we choose to be in bondage to computer technology that prevents us from starting the session on time? Peter.
I think the two kinds of slavery that are being talked about there, in a way, this just came to me as a little idea, have to do with whether or not your slavery is driven by your ego, or your slavery is driven by the absence of your ego. Because I think that's what kenosis, the latter, I think is what kenosis is all about. That is an emptying of yourself, as Paul wrote about in Philippians. That is, Christ emptied himself to the form of slave, is actually the word it's used. It says servant once in a while, but if you really look at the Greek, it's slave. And so it was a, it then, kind of to go back to your first points, it's the kind of slavery that if you have no ego, you have responsibility with it and you are connected to others and the common good. Whereas if your slavery is all about your own ego, and your individualism and getting more stuff and all that kind of stuff, or linked to sin, then it is about the negative freedom you talked about first. That is freedom to be dominant and not to have to worry about if your freedom diminishes the freedom of other people.
Sure. I'm going to push you a little bit on that when you talk about the ego, just because, and I'll talk about that in a second. Christian freedom is certainly not negative freedom. It's not freedom from external restraint, from law. It's not freedom from interference by your community. It's not nihilistic. That's, maybe that could be our word for today. Nihilistic meaning no law. Absolute freedom. It's not that sense of total freedom that you can do whatever you want, whenever you want. Which many commentators think is nihilistic, because you can't make any choices then with your freedom. So you have to have some values to determine what to how to use your freedom prior. And in some ways, that's what Paul is saying, is guess what? You can't be totally free. It's just what is going to sort of determine who you are. And I think in a lot of ways, this is why it's that form of enslavement. Are you going to be enslaved to yourself and your world, or are you going to be enslaved to God? For Christians too, it's dependent on God's actions. God is the one who reveals to us who we are supposed to be. That's our calling as Christians, and we don't determine it. We try to determine it, and maybe that's part of the ego part. We try to determine it, what happens? We go astray. We are slaves to sin. I think many theologians of the last 50 years, they point out that when we become enslaved to our own ideas of freedom and whatnot, things like the Holocaust happen. And I think ultimately, and this is sort of the heart of what I'm going to push us on a little bit, is that Christian freedom then is to properly form one's loves and to see our true calling. What do I mean by that? Paul And many, you know, Augustine, Michael Pellet did Augustine Reads Week, Luther. In a lot of ways, who we are is determined by both how we love and what we love. Mm-hmm. Should I repeat that? Or who we are is determined by how we love and what we love. And what Paul is trying to point out, ultimately, is that what Christian freedom is about is freeing sort of a vicious circle of love in which we aren't able to properly love others in the way God has called us to love. So he says, and I used this last night, this is in Galatians, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for self-indulgence, but through love become slaves to one another. For the whole law is summed up in a single commandment. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, I'm sure most of us are familiar with this. Mm-hmm. Problem, because how do we love your neighbor as yourself? Really, the form here, then, of one's love is it's not individualistic. Because your loves are intertwined and interdependent with your neighbor. And Peter, this is where I'm going to push you a little bit. It's, I think, part of the problem with sort of completely emptying the ego is it can lead to unhealthy self-sacrifice. There's a number of feminist theologians who talk a lot about being in an abusive relationship. That if you so love the other, that you are willing to be abused as a means to help that other, i.e. sacrifice in a lot of ways the way Christ did, then are you properly loving? You've given up your ego. And Paul here too, obviously this comes from the Hebrew Bible, it comes from Leviticus, this love your neighbor as yourself. There is a connection between you and the other that informs how you love. And I think what most of us are much easier sort of in love with ourselves. And the hard part is to love the other equally. So really Paul, I think, is trying to say here is, guess what? There's a proper end of love, the other. But alongside of that love of the other is the love of itself. So it's, they're equally intertwined. There's an interdependence there. It's not individualistic, but your other's needs equal your needs. There's that type of mutuality. Meaning it's not self-denial, but right self-love and other love.
Berlin and I were talking after last night's session a little bit that one of the conceptualizations of sin was that sin was about self and pride. And we were tossing around the idea that maybe that sin is not about pride, but about fear. And there's very frequent references to freedom from fear. Mm-hmm. And then that squares with this, because loving your neighbor as yourself allowed sort of for me to care about you means that I'm no longer afraid of you. It's less about me getting past myself and me getting over my fear of the other and my fear of what could come next and being able to operate. Although that's sort of a negative freedom, freedom from fear. But that could be what
I think
what faith
a real...
brings is a freedom from fear of death, freedom from fear of the evil, because that's been taken care of.
I think there's a real vulnerability in this type of other regard. You have to be open to being changed and transformed and grow and develop in new ways that you might not want to. Now, I think for those of us who have been in a committed relationship, I mean, how many times do you wake up next to your spouse going, gee, this person has really changed me? Hopefully for the better. but there's that real sense that, I'm a much less selfish person because I'm married. I'm a much better person because I'm married. Because I have to think about her. And she will tell you many times that I don't particularly do that very well all the time. I'm sure she could spend the next hour talking about that. and same thing with kids. In some ways, I think the thing with kids is that it becomes this incredible focus on them and not you. that becomes almost one-sided, almost de-egofies you as a parent. And then I think that's one of the challenges of you as a parent, is how do you take care of yourself in order to be a good parent to your child? You know, if you don't get sleep, Bisbee, my daughter last night, if I went to sleep at midnight, and I was up for about an hour in the magic circle, because we've been bringing her into her bed, because she's not sleeping. But then Kata doesn't sleep, because she doesn't want to sleep with me, she wants to sleep on top of Kata. So, welcome to usually she's a good night's sleeper. Question though, I think Paul doesn't talk about political freedom. He doesn't talk about the modern nation state. He doesn't talk about democracy. The challenge for us as Christians then is to think about this concept of freedom, yet be citizens of the world. Mm-hmm. How do we be American citizens, Canadian citizens, when ultimately we're called, and this is our true calling? You know, how do we, is this something that we're asked to then form politics around? And I think that's the real tension for us as we live even today. And I think I want to start with sort of one view that equates Christian freedom with political freedom. And I'm sure some of you have heard of the Feed Faith and Freedom Coalition. You ever heard of it?
That's all.
They recently, I think it was early June, they sponsored one of the first Republican debates, of course, because it's heavily conservative. Back with the picture up here, this is Bachman and Trump and the Cain, I don't know who that guy is, Ron Paul, Santorum, and Hollenty. Glad the Minnesotans are looking at it. And they clearly connect faith and freedom. And this is their mission. This is from their website. We believe that the greatness of America lies not in the federal government, but in the character of our people. Right from the bat, it's a negative form of The simple virtues of faith, hard work, marriage, family, personal responsibility, and helping the least among us. If we lose sight of these values, America will cease to be great. Step one of their mission statement. Here is part two. Their mission is to educate, equip, and mobilize people of faith and like-minded individuals to be effective citizens. Together, we will influence public policy and enact legislation that strengthens families, promotes time-honored values, protects the dignity of life and marriage, lowers the tax burden on small businesses and families, and requires government to tighten its belt and live within its means.
The car in every garage and the chicken in every pot.
Any thoughts about how they go from sort of the Christian concept of freedom to this attitude about freedom?
I've never understood that leap.
No.
It makes no sense.
Our faith, not faith generally.
Well, I think they certainly believe that, and I hate to say they because. I think it's important that we are respectful conversation partners with those we might not completely agree with. But I think this particular group clearly assumes that, let's say, degrees of truthiness, that their degree of faith truthiness is more truthiness than other forms of Christianity. I think truth is truthiness, that John Stewart term.
That's a Colbert.
Colbert term. Right.
Their comment about third line down the character or second line character of our people. But if you're going to be a person of good character, it seems to me what they're saying, you better well fill in, you better well accept the other things that were. In other words, character is a person that, at least I say, accepts their other, not values, but values, actions, and that, and I think that they're limiting it too much. And if you were to divide it, if you were to push out character to involve more actions, they wouldn't, I guess they wouldn't consider you a person of good character.
Well, I think the issue becomes exactly, obviously, what is a person of good character? Exploring the website, part of the frustration for me as an academic is I'm used to deep argumentation and reasoning. And they don't make a lot of the leaps that many of us are asked to do, either as a pastor or an academic or an educator or even someone making conversation. I shouldn't have said that, but you know, I do think that they're clearly associating personal responsibility and faith with sort of making sure that you're taken care of. And by your ability to be taken care of, you can take care of other people. I mean, in some ways, that's the assumption. The assumption is that we as individuals, or each of you as an individual, then has a personal responsibility. So go be successful in the world, and by being successful in the world, i.e. making sure that there's negative freedom in the institutions that we've established, then you can actually love your neighbor. But don't let government get in the way. Never love.
It seems like they've turned freedom into a code word. You know, like when Sarah Palin starts her toss off, "Don't you just love our freedoms?" and everybody cheers. It's like it's an inside thing, like it's their freedom is different than our freedom. I mean, who doesn't love freedom? That's a crazy thing to say. You know, but this kind of twisted a bit, sort of, you know, make it sort of a, when they say freedom, it's meaning something else.
It's certainly, I think a code word is well said. I think part of the brilliance of how certain people use it, it's kind of vacuous. Anyone can read anything they want into the language. You know, there's many interpretations. And, you know, I think most of us here are, you know, like Verlon, I think you kind of said this, that we all love freedom too. And when you use a word that's so broad, the question is, does it have any meaning?
Exactly.
Which in some ways is what I want to ask too, that it's, you know, shouldn't we be saying Christian freedom? Rather than this legal political freedom, when we think about freedom, when we think about true freedom, and sort of prophetically critique, in a lot of ways, how it's used within our political discourse?
Well, some of them would probably be delighted to say Christian freedom, but they fear they won't be elected if they do that. So, I mean,
then there's other ones who don't mind Shabbat, says it all the time.
Right, although I'm not even sure that even she would put it in print, like, you know.
I don't know. I'm curious now that she's running for president what her website looks like. I know she just released an ad in Iowa. Mm-hmm. But it was all about her growing up in Iowa. Now she's in Iowa. So. Ma'am, I think you had your hand up.
Well, that second paragraph, those first two lines, that mobilizing people are faith and like-minded individuals. That seems oxymoron to me. How you can say like-minded to be effective citizens. It doesn't make sense.
I think they're trying to cast as broad a net as possible. So
yeah.
People of faith and other morally correct but maybe not faithful
right.
People. So they seem to be, the first paragraph is all about getting you nodding.
Yeah.
I'm for that. And then they start to kind of slide into thoughts that they're going to sell you.
Yeah.
Once you're sort of bobblehead nodding, yeah, that's a good idea. Freedom. Who doesn't want freedom? So.
Or, you know, the character of our people is such great American character. Kato?
Well, I'm just wondering about if the word freedom could ever really help us enact what it is that we think it's working us towards, since I think in political discourse, we're always freed against something, right? Like there's always something that's trying to hold us back or some sort of or way of thinking that are going to keep us in bondage, whereas like with Christian stuff you're talking about, it's sort of our own self in some ways that keeps us in bondage, our own desires, our own sense of sin or whatever, and politically it seems like all of those things are externalized, and so freedom in political sense seems like it will always be a dangerous and loaded term, because underneath it is this idea that there is something that is pushing against you and trying to keep you from being free. And so part of this rhetoric underneath it is, who are the people or what kind of thing is it that's going to keep you from doing that? And then let's make sure that they don't have power, right? I mean, I don't, so I don't know if I can imagine freedom ever being an entirely good word in political discourse because of what it implies. Does that make sense?
Because it's always attached to some system of oppression or some...
Right.
Freedom from.
Yeah,
right.
Freedom from.
I mean, I've wondered myself just what does freedom mean in the public square today? And it obviously means many different things. And as you said, it's just become this sort of squishy word that nobody can argue with. You don't dare say anything against it.
Mm-hmm. Well, partially, I think most of us, like Berlon was mentioned, I believe in freedom. You know, it's not that I'm opposed to freedom. I think most of us here, I think most of us believe that there is some value and benefit to all of us the way things have been ordered in our country. And obviously, it's been incredibly skewed depending on where you are within the gender and ethnicity scale. But that, you know, even, you know, freedom is something that we use partially because it does benefit us, most of us. So
it seems like the political spectrum is divided in their definition of freedom across that negative versus positive freedom line. Constitutionalists are all about freedom from oppression, freedom from government interference, freedom from...
Sort of libertarians, I believe, too.
Yeah, and you know, that's why I said, I'm not saying Tea Party or conservative, because anyone who's sort of aligning themselves with a strict constitutionalist and freedom from, but then on the other end of the spectrum, you get people who are arguing freedom to marry, freedom to choose what I do with my body, freedom to do all kinds of other things. And maybe that's the dialectic.
That's interesting.
When we talk about freedom across the political spectrum, it's that negative versus positive freedom. Those of us that are looking for freedom to do the things that we want to do are not arguing that we're trying to be liberated from oppression. We just want to be able to be.
We could also divide along independence versus interdependence, you know. I mean, that our, you know, 4th of July is Independence Day, right? It's all about the self. I mean, self and individual being independent from something, right? Whereas the Christian term was about interdependence. And I just wonder if, you know, so much of our, the American myth of pulling oneself up by one's bootstraps, you know, I don't know. Like, how do we get rid of that mythology of success, right? Because it seems like that has to be replaced by a mythology that involves community interdependence and worthiness, right? But I mean, so much of this is still rooted in an idea that you should be doing it for yourself first and foremost, and if you can't, then there's a problem with you.
And for those of you who were in my session yesterday with Gary North, I mean, he starts out his little Christian economics text with a quote, and those of you weren't, it was 2 Thessalonians, that says, if you do not work, you do not eat. That God created a good earth, and that earth can support life, and there's an abundance, but human sin has led to economic scarcity, and if you don't work to develop who you are, you don't eat. Now that kind of attitude is prevalent. And,
there wasn't a lot of support for that.
I agree, but the problem, you know, the problem is this is an influential group. I mean, think about who they were able to attract to the first presidential debate. Pretty much everyone that matters in the Republican Party right now that's running.
How do they justify that plank in their platform where they mention taking care of our most vulnerable, though? Because
Yeah, help the poor, the needy, and those who have not much. I mean, I think this is where personal responsibility is. If you think about our principles, and it doesn't say 1, 2, 3, 4, hierarchical, but in some ways, I think there is a hierarchy that is also coded, too. I mean, respect for the sanctity and dignity of life. Family and marriage is the foundations of a free society.
Those who have been left behind, is that kind of a hint
at the... where's that? Oh, yeah, the poor.
The poor that needed those who were not taken up.
I mean, what they're really saying is, you know, Okay,
it's all of us, right?
Yeah, really. Here we are.
That is, I never thought about it like that. You know, in some ways, what I see here with the way this is ordered is, one, where does life for us start? Not with government, but with families. We as families, strong families. And if we have strong families, we don't need government. Because the families can replace all those other great things that the government might think. Homeschooling. I mean, a lot of homeschooling movements come out of conservative Christian.
Yeah, how about all the families that don't fit that mold? I mean, think of how many single parent families there are in the United States, and, you know, gay and lesbian, you know, together families that have kids. And this would be interesting to look at the numbers.
Yeah.
Of a nuclear family, never been divorced, either parent, and only their biological kid.
Yeah.
What percent that would be?
I'd be curious about that too. You notice they also, and they end victory in the struggle with terrorism and tyranny while supporting our democratic allies, including Israel.
No terrorism or tyranny there.
Including Israel.
Well, they want to make sure that they don't just get Christian votes.
Well, they're going to get the evangelical Christian votes, is what they're
doing. They want a couple of them.
Yeah. I'm going to skip Rush now. But
thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I want to make sure I cover some. I just want to point out, too, that there are forms of sort of loosely associated with the Democratic Party that also espouse this kind of language. It's not just on the right. This is known as the Democratic Freedom Caucus. It's more regionalized than it is national, but there are a number of senators in the Senate who have signed on to it. It doesn't use the faith language, but it promotes personal responsibility and sort of almost a libertarian approach to governance. I'll just read the mission. The Democratic Freedom Caucus is a progressive pro-freedom caucus in the Democratic Party. The purpose of the DFC is to promote individual liberty, constitutional democracy, and social responsibility. Individuals should have the freedom to live their lives the way they want to, as long as they respect the right of everyone else to have the same freedom. And then each person should have personal liberty and economic liberty. Liberty also requires social responsibility. Partially, this is a little different because it talks about social responsibility, at least giving a shout out to some type of social element and dimension to who we are as individuals. But, you know, they use the language of freedom. It's free markets here, too. It's not socialism. It's not sort of radical forms of the end of private property, for instance, and things like that. So it's not just on the right. And I want to be clear about it. I think it's much more pervasive on the right, and frankly more effective on the right, especially with certain cable news channels, like Coyote News, like Fox. I want to, though, because we started late, I want to start now with sort of a contemporary thinker, James Cone. Anyone familiar with James Cone? I know for a lot of
them. Well, if I'm not, then I would be glad to have you spend just a moment saying where he's come from.
Oh, sure.
And why he's important.
Sure. He's still alive. I want to say he's in his upper 70s. He was born, I'm going to get this wrong, you know. He was born in, like, a sharecropper's son in, like, Alabama, I think. Vermont, do you know?
Yeah.
I think it's Alabama, and he went to a small school there. And he eventually went to Union Theological Seminary in New York City. And he sort of came of age as a theologian during the Civil Rights era. And in the early to mid-60s, obviously, in our country, there was the demand on the parts of those who had been excluded from fully participating in our democracy, especially African Americans, the ability to participate. And what he wanted to do is really take Christian theology to task for its bias. And his brilliance, in my opinion, is the fact that he learned all about white theology, is what he calls it. He learned Barth, he learned Luther, he learned Kierkegaard, he learned Tillich. And what all these thinkers had in common is that Barth says, guess what? I'm writing universal theology. It adheres to and fits well with everyone's experience. Kierkegaard does that. Luther does that. He doesn't say, well, this is true for Germans or proto-Germans in the 16th century. Luther's making universal claims. Paul makes universal claims. And what James Cone does is says, guess what? You can never read anything or interpret anything apart from your experience as a part of a culture. And what is his experience as an African American? It's not being a citizen. It's being defined as colored, in which the whites tell the colored what they are. And he thinks, and quite convincingly, he sort of makes this critique of what he calls white theology, saying that there's a bias there. It promotes the power and privilege of whites within a white culture. They don't speak to me. They don't speak to my oppression. They don't speak to the fact that I walk out the door and people look at me differently. That when I go to the store, people follow me around because they think I'm going to steal something. Which is unfortunately still true today. I have a good friend of mine who's African American. He went to Princeton. He's very charismatic. He'll go to, when he lived in Chicago, he would go to the northern suburbs, he'd get pulled over for no apparent reason. Are you lost? Is what they would say. Well, James Cone then says, well, what is Christian theology then? And for him, he becomes sort of the leading voice of black theology, which is a form of liberation theology. He does a lot of work eventually with liberation theologies in Central America and South America, because there's a lot of commonalities, though they recognize the fact that what theology really then is making sense of God within one's context, through one's experience. That's how you read the Bible. It's first. And if you think about sort of the basic paradigm of Lutheran theology, it's the belief that ultimately the Bible is the source of authority, sola scriptura. Believing that in some ways the Bible tells you what it's supposed to mean. And what Cone is suggesting in a lot of ways is that the Bible doesn't. The Spirit in your context, God is in your context, enabling you to find a message that keeps you alive in that scripture. Because really, for Cone, in particular his earliest in the late 60s and early 70s, I mean, it is about staying alive. When every day people tell you you have no dignity because you are not white, that you are not a true citizen, that you cannot participate fully in one's democracy. So it's clearly about freedom. But in a lot of ways, the freedom he talks about, and this is from Black Theology of Liberation, liberation means that the oppressed must define the structure and scope of reality for themselves. That's what freedom is. And he thinks that's the essential message of Christianity. This is a quote about what he thinks Christian theology is. Christian theology is a theology of liberation. This means that its sole reason for existence is to put into ordered speech the meaning of God's activity in the world, so that the community of the oppressed will recognize that its inner thrust for liberation is not only consistent with the gospel, but is the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he uses the Exodus story, he uses the prophetic literature in the Hebrew Bible, and he also uses Jesus quite a bit, obviously. And he talks about how Jesus is here to preach good news to the poor. So Christian theology, and he, you know, this is a theology text, and you can see that this is very well ordered. You know, for any of you who are pastors or quasi-theologians or theologians, I mean, he's defining what theology is. It's ordered speech about where God is in the world. And for Colin, where is God? God is with the Christian community that is fighting for freedom. That's where God's liberative activity is. And he makes no bone about the fact that ultimately that's pretty much the only place God is. Because if God is all about liberation and freedom and self-determination, then God isn't about power, privilege, wealth. Instead,
God is about ending oppression. He also, and I think this goes well with Paul, is he says no one is free until all are free. And he believes, and I think this goes well with the love your neighbor as yourself, if we are connected to each other, part of the problem is guess what? My happiness and freedom are connected with other people's happiness and freedoms. And his point in a lot of ways too is that people like me, and I've talked about clothes, but I remember when I bought these shorts. My wife always tells you, I always remember where I buy my clothes. I bought it in Minneapolis, and it was on sale, so I bought it, came home. Well, it's made in Burma. And Burma isn't particularly known for its democratic procedures and whatnot. And when I got home, I was kind of like, gee, I'm going to wear something, and obviously I still wear it, that really comes from an oppressive country. It comes from an oppressive regime. And I think the point of Cone is that all of us are tied together in ways we don't conceive of. You know, I look at your shoes. I always think about shoes now, because most shoes aren't made in the United States by companies that pay living wages. I mean, most of our clothes aren't made. My computer's made in China, and there's been lots of discussions, apparently, like, the factories that make Apple products in China, like, the suicide rate every month has been going up. Because they work like 16 hours a day, and the pay isn't particularly good, and Apple's trying to do something, but you know, the labor market in China is so competitive that all these bidders are competing, and of course, we want products that we can afford. So the real cost of the product for us is only monetary. But there's all these other factors that we aren't challenged to think about that we're attached to. You know, we're attached to these things and our lifestyle and our comfortability. So in a lot of ways, we're not free because we're not free to truly care about those people in China that are making Macs or in Burma. I want cheap shorts. Yeah.
How would a theologian like Cone, liberation theologists reconcile to Jesus' render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, his disappointment of the Zionists at the time who wanted a political Messiah, and that appears to not be what he was here to do?
That's a good question. Usually it's used as a means to not suggest nonviolence or whatnot, at least for Cone. What it's used to suggest ultimately is that, guess what? If we think that there are these two separate spheres, that the political and the social, we sort of misunderstand Jesus' call that all of us, no matter what locale we're a part of, are called to be fulfilled, called to be free, called to be able to serve each other. So our calling and our real freedom to love each other trumps any divisions that we have within society. I mean, ultimately, Cone doesn't think we'll ever get to a point where we will be colorblind as a culture. But we're still called to it. We're called to make sure that everyone has that same ability to live out a life of love. And that trumps any of the differences we have, any of the splits between what's God and what's Caesar's. Because ultimately, everything's God's,
right.
Even Caesar's.
Okay, that's helpful.
And, you know, it's also true that there are lots of different forms of liberation theology. A lot of the earlier theology that comes out of especially South America, in particular Peru, that's heavily Marxist. It's also heavily Catholic. And it's so Catholic that there's lots of tensions between that type of liberation theology and traditional Catholicism because of its use of Marxist theology, mixed Marxist theology. Mm-hmm. Cone is, you know, he comes out of the Black Church tradition. It's heavily influenced by Protestantism. He doesn't quote Catholic tradition. He does quote a lot of white thinkers that are Protestants, you know, the Bart. He quotes Luther. He actually liked Luther for a little bit. He thought Luther was helpful in the sense that Luther made it about one's relationship to God as defining of oneself, not one's relationship to the church. And so Cone thinks what the church really is, at least in this thing, he does change, I mean, because the context changes. And he also is very later on in his life, he's very critical of some of his earlier writing because it was gender exclusive. Mm. It was gendered.
Yeah.
And so he takes to task black men, for instance, who because they're so low on the totem pole, are oppressing women, especially black women.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, he hasn't moved into the gender or sexuality issues, though I suspect he probably has. Other thoughts? Yeah.
I guess, and this may not be relevant, but I guess my frustration level is we've been coming up to Holden now for many, many years. And the question is always, you get back, and if you're up here for a week, how do we bring this back? And of course, we don't. And we've been in a couple of churches for a long time, and really, I think the churches that do a wonderful job. But unless you go to a class like this, or unless you go to, I took some seminary classes just to do it a few years and really get into some discussions and thought, it seems to me that Christian theology should be an important, I don't want to say subject, but important enough for, the clergy, the others to dare to get into this mode, not necessarily have the answers, but even to discuss this, for us to deal with it. I really think that Holden, the visitors at Holden, are not that different than a lot of the members of the church outside. But I've been involved enough in the church outside to know that there's a fear factor there. Maybe we shouldn't get too involved in this. My frustration, again, is that as much as I like seeing this, and this will get me back to read something. I may not agree with it, but at least the discussion of what is Christian theology and what we should be doing. And I just think the churches ought to be approaching this or exposing us sitting in the pews in the back a little bit more of these thoughts. I'm sorry, it's just a frustration that I have, and I don't know what the answer is, and there's nobody to blame, but I just wish we could do that more.
Maybe, it's almost time, but since I started late, I'm glad, obviously, to stay longer. I mean, maybe we should ask that question, which I'm sure is asked each week, maybe each bus departure, is what is the relationship between Holden and the world and some of the reflection that we're able to do here about these kinds of issues and where we end up? I mean, I see lots of faces out here that I know come back every year. And obviously, there's a reason you come back. It's not just the food. What are some thoughts?
I think one of our challenges is that within the political world, we rarely find people that are willing to run on the social issues that might be important to us, that are comfortable talking about faith and standing up to a Michelle Bachmann and going toe-to-toe theologically, when someone says this is the Christian thing to do, to actually find someone who has a theology like this, who's willing to stand up and say, no, I don't think so. I mean, you can say it that way if you want to, but Christianity is not about fear. It's not about making people afraid that the government's going to come take your stuff. So we haven't had a national level Democratic leader since Carter, who was comfortable with faith, that looked comfortable talking about faith. At some level, we need the antithesis of Michelle Bachmann to run, whether it's in Minnesota or Washington, and to support those people who will stand up and be comfortable with faith, talking about the issues that are important. A couple of slides ago. Freedom too.
Peter, Ricky probably know better. John Marty. I mean, John Marty he's been up the whole quite a bit. His father is Martin Marty. He's a representative, or he's a senator, I think, in the state senate. And he ran for governor. He ran most recently in Minnesota, but he ran and won the nomination. Is it in the early 90s, or is that right? but he lost by the greatest margin in Minnesota gubernatorial history. And he uses a lot of this language. He's comfortable with it, and he's someone I really respect as a politician. And there's stories of him, for instance, where I think it was about the flag one time that a veterans group had given him money, and the legislature was trying to pass a non-burn the flag amendment, and he didn't support it. And the veterans group came up to him and said, we need to really change your mind, and otherwise give your money back. And John Marty said, I'd be glad to give your money back, but I do not believe that we should hold the flag to be sacred in the way that we're clearly in there. I apologize if that harms you, but this is what I believe, and this is my calling as a Christian, and things like that. It's not just, we could say that the real issue is the fact that our elected officials actually really do represent what we want. That Michelle Bachmann does. She's reelected. I'm not in her district. I don't fully understand how she could be reelected, but she is, pretty convincingly. Mm-hmm. And so are they sort of, in my opinion, they're not necessarily, the elected officials aren't necessarily the problem, because they do really represent, that we elect them. It's how democracy works. So the issue becomes, the underlying social structure, I use socialist terms here, but the underlying myth, Kate brought that up, I think that's important, but how do we change that? And maybe that's where we as Holden, we go out in the world and we stand up for this kind of perspective. And we say, I'm proud to be a Democrat and a Christian. Right. I don't find any conflict in being a Democrat and a Christian. Mm-hmm. My calling is as a Christian first, but I think I can see how being a part of, a citizen of the United States includes me finding ways to live out my calling to love myself and others equally. And it's not divorced then from politics and citizenship. And I think, to me, that's both hard, because it's not always easy to find and expect situations. I think most of us are aware of times when someone near us says something inappropriate about an African American, some racist joke or sexist joke, and to me, those are signs to say, look, I respect you, but that's inappropriate. Then, and that's hard, because sometimes we value that relationship more and don't want to risk that vulnerability, that fear of kind of doing the right thing as Christians. Kayla?
I was just going to say, I just wonder if, I feel as guilty of this, if I'm part of this too, but if, to a certain extent, what we do is we've moved beyond viewing our personal family unit as the top, the sort of conservative thing message sort of stated. But I think sometimes we put all our energy just into our specific church congregation, and that becomes sort of our larger family that we're going to take care of. And what I see in our church is that people are amazing at doing great things for our church community. We have put a ton of money into building a bigger building so that we can have better Sunday school rooms. Sure, educating these kids is a great thing. People go on mission trips here and there and stuff, but I feel like the majority of our efforts stay within that building. And I don't know how to solve that, but I mean, you're sort of asking why does it seem to sort of stop? And I think I see a lack, and maybe it's because we're in Northfield, which is, 40-minute drive from Minneapolis, and our church isn't in the inner city. It's not directly in a place where I think we see need on a daily basis, though certainly there is need in Northfield. But I see a distance for us, at least in our church community, that church has become sort of the greater insular family that we protect and that we put all of our sort of theological energies toward, and the rest of the world kind of fades away a little bit.
Ferlon, let me say one thing first.
I think we don't want to get beat up. I mean, that's And we see people get beat up. I mean, Obama's a Christian. Obama is, trying to do this thing where he's not, he's trying to be fair, trying to open it up for everybody, whatever. But we can sit on TV and watch him get beat up. We can watch the Republican Party beat him up on TV. And that's no different than what happened to Christ or what happened to any, anybody who tries to go this path, like Mark Dayton. You watched him get beat up, And I think we're afraid of getting beat up. We don't really have a way to sustain ourselves once we get beat up. We just get, there are people out there ready to beat us.
Well, and I'll say another thing, and I think you had brought this up in a conversation a couple days ago. I also think a real difficulty of us, and our culture has done a good job of doing this, that we have this kind of translucent border between being Christian and the rest of our life. Mm-hmm. We have church on Sunday and maybe another time a week, but then we go to work and we're surrounded by coworkers and whatnot, and we do our jobs. Mm-hmm. And we come home and then we're a husband or a wife or a partner or a father or a mom or uncle. And I think the real challenge is how do we integrate everything so as to, in some ways, being Christian is integrated throughout all of those roles that we sort of perform. And I think because, we talked about this a little bit on Tuesday, that we live in a politically liberal society that in some ways asks us to be wary of faith discussions and sort of putting Christianity or faith commitments first, because we want to be good citizens and not offend anyone else, or we want to make sure the space doesn't lead to conflict, not just being beaten up because of what we believe, but because we have to work with these people. Our success as a lawyer, a pastor, garden maintenance man depend on those kinds of, and I don't know the answer to it, but I do think that's the demand that we fall under as Christians, that it's not a Sunday thing. It's how we see the world, it's how we act, and we should be demanding sort of greater accountability from the world to what we think is a higher calling.
Peter? Yeah, I think it gets back to who is your neighbor, who is the other, is it just the people, to the families that exist in the church, is it, beyond that, and to tie that into what Michael Pellett's been doing on grace the other night. He said, grace by definition flows down from God. What needs to come from you is thanks up to God, but is incomplete without a horizontal component of charity. And so that's the responsibility that we're talking about. And different people define who we're responsible to in different ways, both as Christians and, in politics. And what Jesus said, he broke everything totally loose, because before then the law was, you were not supposed to, you were supposed to love Israel to build the nation and to have it thrive, and you're supposed to hate your enemies. And he said, love your enemies. That gives you an idea where the kingdom of God says the other is. It's everything.
But charity is inconsistent. Just giving charity is very inconsistent in working with the problems in our society. It depends on so much. It depends on how the people given the charity feel. It depends on how much money they have. It depends on, it's not as consistent as fixing a part in our government where we automatically give to people. And that's what the people, like you mentioned earlier, I forget their names,
faith, the freedom of
religion. People. That's where they want to screw up. They don't mind churches giving charity because they understand the inconsistency of that, and that churches really can't do it all. What they want is to make sure that there's no consistency.
Well, go and be free.
Politically or
yes.
It's a, you know, it's a multivalent term. So that's a good time to
Thank you.
Thank you.